Here at Renew Energy Partners, climate change is very important to us, and so is beer. In every episode of the Green Beers podcast, we taste a beer together. We talk about the brewery and their sustainability practices. And then we talk about a topic relating to our work in decarbonizing buildings and mitigating climate change. Welcome to Green Beers. My name is Mike Savage, and today I am with
Charlie Lord, and we're here with our special guest,
Bill Davis.
Bill Davis, pleasure to have you. And today we are drinking a wonderful, especially hard to get Treehouse Green, as we all begin to pour into our brand new pint glasses for the Green Beers Pod.
Yeah. Well, I got to say, Bill, this is yours to take home, the Green Beers pint glass, and we hope it'll be a real collector's item.
I'm super excited, and I'm actually sort of surprised that with a podcast called Green Beers that this is the first time you've actually had green
I know. As the beer. Can you believe that? This is the one podcast in our whole series where it all sort of flows together. Everything's coming together. We got Bill Davis. We're drinking a green beer for Green Beers.
Absolutely. So, Bill, do you want to talk a little bit about your background and what brings you into this ecosystem of decarbonization dialogues?
Yeah, sure. So I think it was about the year 2002. I had started off my career doing, basically marketing data science type work. And I got interested in sustainability. And I don't really have any idea why, except that I have kids. I have four kids who are no longer kids at this point. But I think that for me, I began to think about their world a little bit more than my own. Mm-hmm. And, any exploration of the future probably is going to consider a world that is less hospitable than the one we grew up in, with resource constraints and geopolitical problems and climate-related problems and all the things, frankly, that we're seeing right now. And so that led me to pivot into renewable energy, actually. I ran what was a venture and private equity-backed early stage renewable energy company, kind of in the circular economy space, taking post-consumer wood waste and looking to convert it into a renewable syngas.
What was that called?
ZGen.
ZGen. Oh, wow.
Yeah, it was an interesting company. I mean, we were featured on Science Channel, on Discovery Channel. Notably, we survived 08. We were actually going into the market just as fate would have it. Having spent most of our Series A funding in the summer of 08, and, it was an apocalypse out there. I literally remember with the chairman of the board going down to New York for a couple of days of meetings at Bear Stearns and Lehman Brothers. And it turned out we were a couple of days too late.
Too late. That's funny because we had a guest on earlier this season, my sister Deirdre, who runs a company called the Megawatt Hour, which does a software as a service procurement for companies and businesses in New York. Some of the guts of that company originated with a company called Juice Energy, which was an early energy trader in the deregulated markets. They had built a huge book of business by August of 2008 when they, at the behest of their chair of the board, switched their capital partner to Lehman Brothers. And we're out of business by October of that year.
We actually had sort of an amazing story. We ended up getting some inreach, as we frequently did, from what turned out to be a very large family office in the country of Oman. And they expressed interest in visiting our demonstration plant, which was down in New Bedford, and investing. And I was thinking, okay, well, this is starting to feel like a Nigerian scam. But in any case, the guy showed up, and 2 weeks later, their head of M&A was scheduling another trip here. And 3 months later, Jim Matheson from Flagship, who was the board chair of ZGen, and I went over to Muscat, Oman, and closed a deal. And we ended up with a $24 million up round led by the Omanis, by this family office in Oman.
Wow.
So we managed to survive 08. However, The one thing that we couldn't survive was actually fracking, you know, ironically, right? So I think when I founded the company in 2003, the price of NatGas was at $12 an MMBTU. The IEA says, oh, it's going to 20. Well, it went to 2.
Right.
It's like 2 and change.
Fascinating.
And that, the point at which that it kind of got to the lowest level was really around the time we were ready to commercialize. So essentially all the economics
of your plants
flew out the door. I mean, well, we just couldn't do it.
What was the carbon footprint at that time of a wood waste to energy plant or your technology as compared to NatGas?
Well, it's considerably lower because you're number one, the gas you produce is renewable.
Right.
And then secondly, you're actually displacing the formation of greenhouse gases that would otherwise have come from the landfilling or the incineration of the waste.
Of the waste, right.
Because remember, that waste is fuel, and so you're preventing
right
the formation of that. I mean, this was a while ago. I don't remember the exact.
But there was a really good spread on the carbon emissions.
Huge carbon spread.
Yeah, yeah.
Huge carbon spread. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a pretty big shift to go from sort of high temperature chemical engineering to the world of asset management. But the one thing I would say is that I think that once you get interested in sustainability and impact, it's not like you're going to go work for an oil and gas company. I mean, it just becomes a part of who you are.
It's a part of your DNA. And that's the headline is that Bill is the founder of Stance Capital, which is a leading investor in a leading asset manager in the space of helping people put money to work in companies they believe in and that have strong records on carbon and other ESG features.
Yes.
And your road goes from ZGen to Stance, and I'm sure there's some interesting twists and turns, but that's what you're referencing, right?
Yeah, it was pretty much a direct line. I mean,
basically,
when it was clear that ZGen, basically, we just couldn't commercialize it, we sort of, put it on the shelf, if you will. And I had been thinking for a while that there was this thing that we all remember called socially responsible investing. And in its sort of earlier years, which I would describe as everything up to about 2010, the thing that I noticed about it was that, generally speaking, it unapologetically underperformed. Meaning, if you were an investor and you liked the idea of it, you were effectively signing up for concessionary returns.
Right. And actually, interestingly, that's a shared DNA that we have, that Stance shares with Renew, is that we're both committed to proving you can put money to work fighting climate change and not give up on returns. And that's a really, really important story across asset classes.
Yeah, I think that's right, Charlie. So our mission is literally to prove that it is possible in public markets to align capital with sustainable values. And by the way, they don't have to be mine or even yours necessarily. I think that there are many different forms of values aligned investing. But what we have been able to do is parse out different parts of portfolio construction so that the values alignment piece has no responsibility towards doing anything other than aligning values, which is essentially to say that our mission is to prove that if you build portfolios a certain way, values alignment is a free option, irrespective of what those values are.
Hmm. And doesn't have an impact on performance, crucially.
Correct.
Right.
Correct.
Right. So did you launch Stance right after you left ZGen?
Yeah.
Wow.
Oh, no, actually, no. I got recruited to help build a boutique wealth management, asset management firm. I said to the guy who recruited me, who was an old college friend, I said, look, I don't know anything about this space. And he said, that's all right. You know how to build a business, right? And I said, yep. And so I joined him, but I did say to him on the way in, listen, one of the things I'm really interested in is figuring out a way to build portfolios in a certain way that it can accomplish this for investors. And he said, yeah, sounds good. I mean, I don't think he really cared about it, but he said, sure, sounds good. And so, that's how I got into the world of financial services. And then I think this was like 2011, in the summer of 2014, or at the beginning of 2014, I live launched a strategy, which now I'm happy to say has a 10-year track record as of 3 days ago.
Wow.
And I ran it at that firm for a couple of years. And then I just decided I really wanted to build a company that was really purpose-built around this type of investing. And so I left and formed Stance. But essentially, I've been running this strategy since even before the formation of Stance.
Yeah, and you and I met when you were first developing the strategy, but before it became Stance. Yeah,
correct.
Yeah. And the 10-year record is very strong.
Yeah, the 10-year record is great. And I think that because we have been able to generate essentially the performance of the S&P 500 with substantially less risk and volatility while being fossil-free, weapons-free, tobacco-free.
Mm-hmm. That's fascinating. And that goes to the larger point, which a lot of the people that listen to the podcast are interested in for reasons other than beer, to the extent they're out there. And that is, again, the shared DNA we have that you could make decisions about where to put your money and still change the curve on climate change. Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's right. And it sort of reminds me that, you know, in general, impact investing is either in private capital markets or it's in public capital
right.
markets. I mean, there's other things too, but I mean, that's the two big buckets.
Yeah.
And I think some investors think, well, you know, this feels like it's more impact than that. And certainly, if you're investing in U.S. large cap publicly held companies, it's a little bit hard to see what the impact is there. But what I would say is that, first of all, it is those large cap U.S. companies that employ an awful lot of people, have a lot of decarbonization opportunities on their own. And thirdly, they are the ones who are going to buy the most successful, most promising private impact companies, and they're going to actually scale.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I mean, we've talked a lot, and this is a sort of, a pivot point between our two worlds. We've talked a lot about the fact that the momentum in our sector is from the big publicly traded companies that are now setting carbon goals and clearly could never have the capital budgets to do these decarbonization programs themselves. So that's why our model is so important in the next 10 years. But it's getting to the point where they make those commitments and then have to live by them that makes a difference in our business, but it's tied to your point that they're an important driver in the economy to get to a decarbonized world. Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, these are interesting times, as you know, right? So probably more for me than you.
Yeah. We had an interesting 23.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, I'm thinking, you know, this whole anti-ESG thing. You know,
well, I was going to ask you about that. So, yeah.
But I guess what I would say about that movement is that, number one, it's just another form of values alignment, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like even some of the big anti-ESG players like Vivek Ramaswamy, who's running for president, obviously, who runs something called Strive, which is, you know, a anti-ESG portfolio. Well, what it does do is it invests in oil and gas companies, right? So that's in effect a form of values alignment. It just happens to be probably different, very different from yours and mine. And Mike's here, but the whole anti-ESG movement is, in my view, not changing the trajectory of corporate America decarbonizing. What it's doing is it's causing some reframing of behaviors and some couching, and it's not changing the underlying behavior, but it's changing how companies talk about
what they're doing.
Communication. Yeah. I think it's communication, and it's at the end of the day, it's a loud minority that is leading the anti-ESG component. Was at a conference this year with it was an ESG conference, and like they made an announcement, like they had additional police there because of the presence of a conference all about ESG. It is a very interesting time when that's all you focus on. Absolutely.
Well, and when something like an ESG conference attracts potential violence. I mean,
yeah.
Yeah.
It's kind of crazy.
It suggests the the dysfunction of our public dialogues.
Yeah.
But we digress. Bill, how do you respond to the attacks on ESG from the other direction? That is, the people who say, and you mentioned it earlier, it's either hard to make, hard to measure the impact you have when you choose to invest with Stance. And I can say, full disclosure, as somebody who has put money with Bill to invest in Stance from our retirement accounts and so forth, I feel, I wake up in the morning feeling a whole lot better about what's happening with that money, knowing it's in your hands, right? Because I want to have my values aligned. And to me, all the attacks from the other side skip that whole point, right? That I feel better knowing that I'm not invested in fossil fuels. That's worth a lot, right? But there's the criticism goes beyond that to say, well, it doesn't really make a difference on corporate behavior. It doesn't really make a difference on climate change. So how do you respond to those critiques?
So a couple of thoughts. One is it actually makes a huge difference. Well, actually, two things. One is that some of the critics of ESG make a good point, mm-hmm. because a lot of ESG assets are really, how do I say this? They aren't not particularly thoughtful.
Or rigorous.
There's no real methodology. It's kind of chasing a shiny object.
Well,
which it definitely was for the last couple of years.
Right. And, you know, it's interesting. The way you describe it for Stance is no fossil fuels. Where there are people who can say, I'm in a green fund. And what they're really in is a fund where someone has picked the best performing oil company. Mm-hmm. Right. There's a big difference on between those two. And I think there's still a difference between I'm invested in the best performing credible oil company than any oil company. Mm-hmm. I think that's a smaller difference between I'm in an oil company and I'm fossil fuel free, which is the difference between being with you and being with some of these others. But yeah.
Yeah. Well, look, there is no such thing as an ESG strategy. There are as many variations as there are theoretically PMs.
Right.
And I would say that it's very viable for somebody to claim, listen, I'm running an ESG strategy that invests in fossil fuel companies who are being most ambitious around decarbonizing. I mean, that's
right.
A legitimate approach,
right.
And it will attract investors. And by the way, I'm sympathetic to that, because at the end of the day, I don't think fossil fuel companies go away. I just think that they become more renewable, right?
Right.
I mean, Exxon is not in danger of running out of money anytime soon.
Right.
Nor any of the majors.
Presumably, it becomes an energy company, and a lot of them are talking about that transition at the most recent conference of the parties, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And even, you know, although we are fossil free, there is a mechanism through which a fossil fuel company could make their way into our portfolio. They would have to do two things, and they'd have to do both of them, right? They would have to make a date certain commitment to be fully renewable, which, by the way, many have done, which is an easy thing to do because everybody making the commitment is going to be long retired
right.
by the time they get to that date. The second thing that they would have to do, which is much more important and much harder for them to do, is demonstrate that commitment by spending 50% or more of their CapEx on renewables. Hmm. I think maybe Occidental is closest to that, and they're at like 11% or something. So, you know, and the bigger companies are way farther behind. So it's going to be a very long time before
somebody makes it through that screen. Did you come up with that screen, or is that an industry standard of some sort? Or?
No, we came up with it.
That's interesting.
Yeah. Makes a lot of sense. Bill, do you have any guiding principles when it comes to ESG investing or the strategy, anything that you kind of look to as this is the core to the strategy?
Well, what we're looking to do is invest at the intersection of strong underlying fundamentals, meaning financial fundamentals, and attention to off-balance sheet risks, which are ESG in nature. So in order for a company to be in our portfolio, they need to live at that intersection. Think of it as a Venn diagram. And beyond that, no. I mean, we are very unemotional about the companies we invest in. We are very active. We rebalance quarterly. And I just rebalanced our portfolio 2 days ago. And I think 65% of the companies that were in it last quarter are no longer in it. So much of that turnover has nothing to do with ESG because, you know, in a sense, if you're good at ESG, you stay good at ESG. And if you're lousy, you know, you got a ways to go. The real issue is that fundamentally, some companies are a better investment today than they were a week ago or 3 months ago when we last rebalanced. And so a lot of the turnover is actually created by, you know, them having hit their price targets. And now it's time to find something less expensive to invest in.
Got it. Makes sense.
Charlie, back to your question earlier, though, I think, because I'm not sure I fully answered it because we went down a bit of a rabbit hole.
Mm-hmm.
I think that ESG is a thing that's in the eye of the beholder, number one.
Yeah.
In terms of the question of impact, it is best realized by thinking about how proxies are voted. So I would say authentic ESG managers who care about this stuff actually view ownership of stock as a opportunity for a shareholder to actually exercise their influence on a company.
So it's not just where you put your money to work, it's also becoming an advocate as the manager for your investors.
Yeah, absolutely. And some of the issues are as simple as separation of responsibilities between, say, a chairman and a CEO. Mm-hmm. That, by the way, has nothing to do with ESG. That's just kind of
good governance,
right? And by the way, a third of ESG, if not more, is really just about governance.
Right.
But the other part of it is that, you know, big businesses, you cannot solve the problem of decarbonizing unless you get the biggest carbon emitting companies in the world to change their behavior. And some really interesting work came out of the California retirement system is probably like 8 or 9 years ago now, where in an effort to prepare themselves for a net zero portfolio, they decided to carbon footprint their holdings. And if you're like CalPERS or CalSTRS, you kind of own everything in the world, right?
Yeah.
So it's a big undertaking. And when they went through that undertaking, they concluded that something like 70% of all anthropogenic carbon emissions since 1985, my dates are off, could be attributed to just 100 companies globally.
It's amazing.
Which is like staggering, right?
That's amazing.
It's completely staggering. But on the other hand, it's a little refreshing because you've now scoped the problem.
You can get your arms around the issue.
Yeah. And put the other way around. Wow. If you can't solve the problem with these,
you're never going to get there.
You're screwed.
Right. So that's fascinating. We've been increasingly focused on the Russell 1000 and their supply chains. And the supply chains are a big piece of it because, of course, all these OEMs, the ultimate sort of end users, if you will, the big companies, a huge percentage of their emissions are their scope threes, which is the carbon footprints of their suppliers, to be clear about what we're talking about. So we have to work with them and their suppliers, right? Mm-hmm. And there are the reporting that came out this year, building on reporting last year that was released at Climate Week in New York, suggests that indeed an increasing percentage of the Russell 1000 are setting binding carbon targets on which they're measuring on an annual basis. But to your point, of the 600 that have set binding targets, most of those are the lower emitting of, mm-hmm. of the 1,000. If you broke that down by total emissions of those 1,000 companies, the vast majority of those still don't have binding commitments. So
mm-hmm.
It's a good news, bad news story. There's a lot of companies to work with real carbon to reduce, right? But the companies that have the biggest emissions and still need to make commitments and still need to start setting targets. Yeah.
So the good news there is it's not just investors that are leaning into these companies.
Right.
It's the customers of these companies.
Right.
So, for example, I do some lead engagement work within a organization or a joint venture called Climate Action 100 Plus,
mm-hmm.
which, by the way, expanded those 100 biggest emitters in the world to add another 66 companies who are very influential.
Wow. And so this organization focuses on those 166 and what they're doing?
And what it really is it's an investor-led initiative to engage companies by asset owners and managers around the world.
That is really cool.
So in the engagement that I co-lead, and I've been doing it for about 4 years, we now have probably 22 or 23, let's just call it 20, institutional asset owners and managers located all over the world, representing about $4.6 trillion of investable assets that on this engagement are leaning into this one company.
That's amazing.
Now, what I would tell you is
that's really interesting.
More effective than investors, and especially large ones, saying to a company, you know, this is really important to us, is a company's customer saying to them, this is really important to us.
Right.
And so in this particular engagement, one of the largest segments that this company plays in, all of the big customers in that segment happen to be outside the U.S. They happen to be facing their own pressures from investors. And our company that we're working with is effectively the scope three of those other
companies.
So basically, it's kind of like a ecosystem where everybody's kind of leaning into it. And I think if it weren't for that, it would be much harder to get stuff done.
That's fascinating.
Yeah. No, I think scope three is really what's going to drive a lot of action. I mean, I remember like 10 years ago, I was trying to sell solar in some little shop in Providence. They were making these little trinkets, and they're like, no, we have to put solar on for Walmart. Walmart's actually been leading the charge on this stuff for a very long time, but it's now we're seeing it of every organization across automotive, pharmaceutical, retail goods. And it's just we're talking 40, 50% reduction from their supply chain, and it's going to lead to some pretty big big movement. Otherwise, I don't think it would happen as fast.
Right. It pushes it through the economy down to the smallest supplier at some point.
And ultimately, they're doing it out of enlightened self-interest, right?
Right.
Like companies get that if they decarbonize faster than their competitors, it's going to open new markets for them.
You know what's fascinating? Sorry, I think I'm interrupting, but I'm just realizing this is an incredible cycle, right? The engagement you have through the Climate 100 Plus, which is pushing these big companies to decarbonize, which leads them to set goals and decarbonization roadmaps, which outstrips their capital budgets, leads back to what Renew and companies like us do to help them actually implement those projects. But I'd never really thought about the ways in which investor engagement, asset manager engagement on the one hand, and our work really connected, but it's a part of a larger ecosystem to push and make this change happen. It's actually really fascinating, and I never really thought of it until this conversation.
Yeah, and I'm not sure most investors think about the entire ecosystem either.
No.
I think that they're
given that we haven't until just now.
Well, I mean, we sort of know it because we
live and breathe it.
But you know, I think that most big institutional investors are really thinking about managing long-term risk and acting as a fiduciary. And, you know, which is, by the way, different from a retail investor. Retail investors, and you said it yourself, you feel better knowing that you're not investing in companies that are ruining the world any more than we've ruined it, right?
Right.
You're not really thinking about, you probably aren't really thinking about performance risk as much as you are, hey, this is what's important to me, therefore I'm going to exercise my values.
100%.
Big investors are thinking about risk. They're thinking, right, okay, well, what happens if there's a carbon tax?
Right.
What happens if I own a bunch of oil and gas companies and then all of a sudden those assets get stranded?
Right.
And, you know, there's a huge sort of reckoning. I mean, but what I think a lot of investors sort of like intuitively understand but maybe aren't really thinking about is all the dots that get connected when you start a cycle of actually being better and how that filters or, you know, spreads itself out through the entire economy.
Right.
And lifts up smaller companies doing really, really important work.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah. And to that point, it doesn't entirely matter why people are engaged, say, in your engagement, among how you get that $4.3 trillion in assets to focus on this one company. Doesn't really matter why they're there as long as they're there and saying this is important, right?
Yeah, yeah. And again, this is one company, right? And some of the engagers the co-engagers work on multiple engagements because they come from very, very big firms.
Interesting.
In total, the investor base within Climate Action 100 Plus is, I think, something like 500 firms around the world representing $69 trillion of investable assets.
That's fantastic.
So it's, you know, it's kind of getting close to pretty much all the professionally managed money out there. But also keep in mind, some of the targets within this are very elusive. Like you've got Gazprom. I mean, you've got state actors, right, in in China and Russia and India.
Right.
And other places. So
they may not be the first adopters.
No. But, you know, notably, you know, six of the companies who are target companies within Climate Action are in everybody's 401k plan.
Right.
You know, if they own, you know, low priced indexed product.
Right.
So that's kind of, I think that's an important point.
Yeah.
One last question before we switch to beer and the other half of this podcast. Looking forward to 24 and sort of the future of ESG investing, and anything that you're expecting or looking forward to?
Yeah, I'm not sure it's going to happen in 24, but I think that back to what we said earlier about how it's tangibly more, it feels more impactful to do private, you know, impact or sustainable investing than it does public. The reality is, for most investors, though, most of their money should be public because, you know, they're not ready to, they don't have everything they need and beyond what they need. They need liquidity, and they probably can't stomach or shouldn't be a party to sort of wild, you know, like early stage risk, I guess.
Right. Most people who have something to put to work, it's going to be their retirement account or something that needs to be liquid and that doesn't have as much risk.
Yeah, but what I think is going to happen, guys, moving forward, is you're going to start to see hybrid product become available in a liquid wrapper. So an example of that is something that is used very extensively, and actually it's growing in popularity. It's called an interval fund. It's basically a form of a mutual fund, and it's used almost exclusively today in real estate. So think about real estate. It's an illiquid asset. So the way an interval fund works is that 80% of the holdings can be illiquid, but 20% has to be liquid, because essentially the structure of an interval fund is you're guaranteeing an investor the right, which is usually rarely exercised, but the right to withdraw 5% every quarter.
Oh, wow.
Which basically means that if they don't like what they've just done, they can get out over 5 years in, you know, increments, in quarterly increments.
That's so interesting. So it would be a fund that blended, say, a infrastructure investment in a bunch of green projects with a public strategy.
Public, cash, cash-like, something that's liquid.
That's so interesting.
And so I think that's kind of the next generation of all of this. From a, like when we're talking about it, from a product standpoint, I think you're going to see more and more products get built that are hybrids, that have a real kind of a tangible impact component, but also have a liquidity.
Right. And so the people, so retail investors or even larger, certain kinds of investors that right now don't play in direct investing, the kind of stuff that we do where you can really measure the impact on a quarterly basis, will have an access to that without giving up the ability to take money out and put it to work in their lives if they want to or need to.
Yeah, I think that's right.
Wow, that's fascinating. Yeah.
That'd be cool to see that come about.
I think it's going to happen. I mean, I think the other thing that's going to happen is that we're going to stop calling it ESG.
Right.
Pretty quickly.
Well, and for no other reason, it's now a bad word.
Yeah, it's super confusing and, yeah, you know, polarizing and all that. But yeah. I think it's just going to kind of get known as responsible investing. And then eventually, I think it's going to be just kind of
good investing
strategy, right? Like it's like in Europe right now, they don't really talk about ESG because it's so ingrained in everything that it's just assumed that it is. I mean, you know, it's not quite that simple, but I think eventually we're going to get there as well here.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Maybe after the Civil War, who knows?
Yeah, I was going to say we may have some fights to fight before then.
Yeah, there's some civil unrest that needs to get worked through. So with
I'm not happy yet.
Yeah, exactly. Back to the beer.
Back to the beer. Yeah. We all need to sit down and have a beer and hash it out. What was your first beer?
Well, since I was probably like 11 and stole it from my father, it was probably a Budweiser.
That's a very common answer.
Yeah. A lot of fridges, family fridges have been raided. I do believe. Your favorite beer?
Actually, I think in general, I would say Trios.
Yeah.
You can't go wrong.
Although I'm kind of getting to the point where you can't, like, the answer to every beer question cannot be like a IPA or a double IPA.
With a 7.5%
ABV. So, like, increasingly, like, in the summer, I'm moving away from them and doing sort of like German pills or Czech pills.
Have you and I been to Notch together?
We have not.
Okay. You know I'm a co-investor at Notch.
I didn't. I actually know some other co-investors at Notch.
Yeah, there's a lot of people.
I think
there's a lot of people.
Are there like 700 people?
There is.
It's a community.
We have to try Notch actually one time.
Notch is a
tap room that has a couple locations, one in Brighton, one in Salem. And the brewer, Chris, specializes in European lagers and pilsners and has focused specifically on session beers.
Yeah.
It's sort of the IPA, but the counterpoint to the IPA movement, really good tasting, lower alcohol.
All day beer,
exactly.
All right, you know where session beer came from, right?
No.
So it came from factories in England, mm-hmm. or Ireland, I forget which. And everybody, the workers used to go out at lunch and get drunk. And so they basically started making a like lower octane beer.
So that when they went to lunch, they came back ready to rock and roll.
Or they came back at all.
And our most famous question, if you could have one beer with anybody, dead or alive, who would it be?
Well, so I'm going to give kind of an answer, which it turns out can be viewed as controversial, because I was asked this question somewhere else recently, and the answer was Isaac Asimov, because I really love everything he's written, and I just really want to get into the head of these futurist writers who seem to get it right. Right? I mean, I feel like we're heading down exactly towards where these guys were 50 years ago, and of course, right. The guy was incredibly prolific as a writer. Turns out he was also a misogynist and had other problems.
Okay.
Which were probably not atypical during his time, but he's somebody I would love to have had a beer with.
Okay, well, he could, the premise is we're going to have a beer with all these people at some point somehow.
Yeah.
We'll steer away from gender issues and focused on futurists then.
Exactly.
With him. All right, Isaac Asimov, that's cool.
Well, he'll fit in. We got, not from the other bad things, but from the perspective, all sorts of people in there. So,
who else is in there?
Not Plato. Where is it? Who's the Greek guy?
Homer wasn't Homer.
Or Socrates or something?
Socrates.
No, it was wasn't it Homer?
Yeah, Homer.
Yeah, we have Tiger Woods,
Nina Simone, Brady, Obama.
Tom Brady, Obama. Uh-huh. I said Rachel Carson.
Which Obama?
The former president.
Former president. Yeah. Michelle would be a good guest as well.
Yeah. I'm trying to remember who my sister said. Yeah, we've had a lot. It's a very interesting and eclectic group.
Good.
But it would be a great conversation.
Absolutely. Well, let's get into the beer. So we are drinking Treehouse, and Treehouse is one of the most well-known Massachusetts breweries out there. And they're also one of the more sustainable breweries out there. Some of the things that they've done recently, they've installed a CO2 capture system, and they also have a wastewater treatment facility. So both those things are really impressive. The wastewater capture, trying to find the right number here. Well, so the gas, that's equivalent to 1,500 trees and 100,000 pounds of gas that they're capturing out of their production process.
And then putting it back into other parts of the brewing process, which is pretty good.
And their water recycling is, they were one of the first to have a significant water recycling system powered by Cambridge Innovations, a cool system out there. And they just have an awesome brewery, awesome beers.
No, very strong on sustainability.
Yeah, absolutely.
It helps when you make $122 million a year.
Well, apparently, yeah.
Yeah.
You can. They're minting money.
It would appear. The lines to get there. I remember going during the middle of COVID, and it was just, you weren't allowed inside, and they would open up at noon on a Saturday, and just, you know, snaking all the way around. It was absolutely insane.
You guys remember when they were out in Munson? Their original brewery was like a Quonset hut.
Right.
In Munson. With like a gravel, dirt driveway and parking lot. And the first time I went there, I think it was January or February, I stood in line for, you know, stomping your feet. It was like a Russian bread line, literally. and especially because when you got to the front of the line, they handed you 4 beers because that was the maximum you could get. Because it was
dedication.
Yeah, and people were, there was an article in the Globe I remember reading that people were driving from Buffalo, New York.
Oh, well, I was
to pick up a 6-pack of beer in Western.
Yeah, at least when I was there was a couple of cases, but a couple of times I stopped there in the last two years, I was next to people who'd come up from South Carolina. You know, I mean, it was absolutely insane.
Yeah.
Because you can only buy it there. So Bill, scale of 1 to 10 on flavor. And then there's a 1-point kicker either direction, up or down, for the sustainability. How would you rate the Treehouse?
I'd give it about a 7 on flavor. I mean, it's one of my favorite beers from Treehouse.
Mm-hmm.
I think, I forget whether I suggested or you guys did, but I know I was thinking about it because of the name of the pod. But it's always been one of my favorite beers. It's not like one of the booziest out there. I'd give it a 7 for that, and I'd give them a full point on sustainability.
So an 8 from Bill.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm known for great inflation. Mike for the opposite. So.
This is a great beer. This is a great beer.
Yeah. I mean, I'm going to give them an 8.5 on flavor. This is one of my favorite beers of all time. And then a full point for sustainability. So they're going to be 9.5.
So Mike, you need to play the Russian or the French judge.
Yeah.
Drop a 6 on us.
No. So this is too good to do that. As I've almost finished, by the way, it's also a 7.5%. Like it's not a weak beer. And it's just awesome, for an IPA.
Right.
It's just
so this is a sort of a breakthrough moment because usually you don't like
the IPAs. I don't like.
So the fact that it's that smooth that you like it, we're into a special beer. If
yeah,
Mike special, and Charlie agree.
Special beer, you know, I'm not doing well on dry January, but it is a great beer. I'll give it like an 8.6. I'll go higher, Charlie, than you.
Okay, this is
full
truly
sustainability. Yeah, 1.96. You know, it's up
there. We don't have Nathan here to crunch the numbers, but my guess is that that's going to put it in the top 5.
Absolutely.
Maybe the top, may take over the top spot.
So one thing that's always been interesting to me, I'm curious what you guys think. Treehouse has many, many, many beers.
Yeah.
Like they must have 40 different beers and probably 25 of them are IPAs of one flavor or another. And they somehow or other pull that off. And their beers don't all taste the same. Whereas I think of, you know, like Trillium, which I like. And you and I talked about this. We had a beer at Trillium this summer. I don't care what beer you have. They all taste exactly the same.
Yeah.
And so I think that Treehouse has figured that out. You know, I still think they probably make too many. But at least they have different, slightly different flavor profiles throughout.
Yeah, and I mean, I've noticed the same, and what I've noticed is that I always pick one that I've never heard of at either Trillium or Treehouse, buy it, and then don't like it as much as the ones I know. So what I don't understand is how they manage to sustain, you know, the value proposition of making those other beers.
So a lot of them are just, they'll make them for a week.
Yeah, it's probably novelty, right? Yeah. You got to try the new thing, see if you like it. Yeah.
Yeah.
it's limited batch. You know,
I think with the IPAs, it's interesting to me that both of them have 8 or 10 different beers that are roughly the same. Mm-hmm. And then the question is, how different are they? Different enough to be interesting to keep making them? Yeah, yeah.
But it's a good IPA. Like it's not terribly hoppy, and I think that's why I like it. It's not, you know, you're not, you know, eating grain. So
I think we may have a number one beer, but Bill, this was really fun. Thank you for joining
us. This was great. Thanks for having me.
Beers, and we'll look forward to the return trip.
Awesome.
Yeah. All right. Thanks, guys.
Till next time. Thanks all. Bye.
Green Beers is brought to you by Renew Energy Partners, your partner in building decarbonization. Decarbonizing your building is good for the earth and it's a smart business move, but it's complicated and it can cost you a lot of money. Our goal is to decarbonize your building while saving you money, so all of those retrofits pay for themselves. Learn more at renewep.com.